Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
For some years now, the medical profession has been dealing with distrust and hostility from certain sectors of the population. As research funds are cut and the CDC comes under metaphorical and literal fire, science is under siege. Prepare to hear from a physician leader on the front lines. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Peter Hotez. Dr. Hotez is a professor of pediatrics and molecular virology at Baylor College of Medicine. He is an author and national expert on vaccine science. Dr. Hotez should be well known to this audience from his frequent appearances on media outlets such as CNN and Fox. He is a physician leader of the highest order. Peter Hotez, welcome back to Sound Practice.
Oh, thanks, Mike. It's great to be on with you again.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Dr. Hotez, it's difficult to know where to start. It's been approximately 2 years since we last spoke. In that time, have efforts to advance an anti-science agenda resulted in loss of life?
Yeah, absolutely. Both during COVID, for people who were misled about the COVID vaccine and decided not to get vaccinated, and they ultimately paid for that with their lives. So, you know, my estimate is that 200,000 Americans, 200,000, Mike, a lot, you know, needlessly died because they decided not to take a COVID vaccine and they listened to the disinformation empire. And that was really tragic. And unfortunately now, you know, what we're seeing is that rise in anti-vaccine sentiments around COVID vaccine is spilling over into childhood immunization. So we've just finally now completed a terrible measles epidemic that started in West Texas and spread across the southern Great Plains into four states, Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Kansas, and ultimately caused 100 hospitalizations among kids and some adults, and two needless deaths among school-age kids whose parents decided not to vaccinate them against measles with the MMR vaccine. So this thing is still going pretty strong, and unfortunately it's spilling over into other aspects of science as well.
Let's talk about your just-released book, Science Under Siege, which you've written with Michael Mann. Professor Mann, at least at first blush to me, did not seem like an obvious choice for a co-author. Why partner with a climate change expert?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what happened, we got to know each other towards the end of the pandemic and started to compare notes. And so, Mike, you know, the attacks on climate science probably predate the mainstream attacks on biomedical science and vaccines by a few years. So Mike was sort of a dry run for that. So he was getting attacked for being a prominent climate scientist, first at Penn State University, not the University of Pennsylvania, like I was being attacked for vaccines. And we started to notice that in some cases, the attacks were coming from the same sources and use that as an opportunity to report on an enlarged anti-science ecosystem that includes attacks on vaccines and other aspects of biomedical science and climate science, and scientists recognizing that in some cases they're coming from the same sources. I mean, if you think of them as two circles of the Venn diagram, you know, one circle of attacks on climate science, one attacks on biomedical science, they're not totally overlapping, but there is significant overlap. And we felt that was important enough to report on, just because the fact that both pandemics and climate science represent two of the most existential threats to humankind. And I think the main point of the book now is now we can't even begin to tackle climate change or begin to tackle pandemic threats because the disinformation empire is so robust.
Your book opens with some disturbing stories of personal threats directed towards you and even your family. Following the shootings at CDC that involved hundreds of rounds being shot off, are you and other nationally known scientists safe?
Yeah, it makes you worry, and it's something that does keep me up at night sometimes. And you don't want to overreact to and have it change your lifestyle, but you have to be smart. I mean, I still like to be out and about and go with my family to a restaurant or take walks with my wife or take walks in the neighborhood and around the medical center. But, you know, it's starting to be troubling that just because the tenor and the level of aggression is so bad. I mean, you see it on social media, particularly X, which has all the bots and trolls, but you also see it, you know, in my emails to me. I've even had some physical confrontation, stalkings at lectures and things, or even in my home. So it is a general trend. It's not getting better and maybe getting worse, particularly, you know, with some of the people that we have now in charge of Department of Health and Human Services that are really piling on with the anti-vaccine rhetoric, especially.
In Science Under Siege, you state that the Russian government has engaged in a campaign of disinformation, quote, to sow doubt and division about vaccines, unquote. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, and so we have a whole chapter in our book called Petrostates. You know, it's because, you know, some of these, by petrostates, we mean nations that have kind of a one-dimensional economy, highly dependent on oil and energy and fossil fuels. And Russia is kind of becoming that, you know, over time. And we provide a percentage of their economy, you know, that depends on oil and gas. So in that case, some of the petrostates, including Saudi and Russia, attack climate science and scientists and in a very transactional way. It's clear what they're doing. But you might say, okay, well, what's the point of attacking biomedical science or vaccines? And in fact, you know, with Saudi Arabia, since I spent time there as U.S. science envoy in 2015, 2016, they're not really going after biomedical science or scientists. So that's a place where there's divergence, that the attacks on climate science are not the same as biomedicine. But Russia is doing something very interesting. It's in that they also like, in addition to specifically targeting climate change and climate science, they like to look at different wedge issues that divide the United States or divide democratic republics. And one of them is vaccines. So and this was even before the pandemic. My colleague David Broniatowski at George Washington University, is a computer scientist, looked at what Russia was doing. And in their case, they were flooding the internet with both anti-vaccine and pro-vaccine bots and trolls, because the goal there is to destabilize democracies. And they look for certain wedge issues that will get people jazzed up and angry, and vaccines became one of them. And so vaccines and then COVID vaccines also became a real target. There was also another reason, and this was documented by the New York Times and others, that the Russians wanted to discredit Western COVID vaccines in favor of their own Sputnik vaccine. So in a very transactional way. So, but the product of that is they will target vaccine scientists and virologists in an effort to destabilize democracies, and unfortunately, it's very effective.
Certain states, New Hampshire, for example, are considering removing requirements for children to be vaccinated for measles and polio. I say again, polio. Have we gotten to the place in 2025 where the polio vaccine is suspect?
It Yeah, it's pretty awful, isn't it? You know, we worked so hard to eliminate these diseases. So measles was eliminated from the U.S. in the year 2000. And, you know, the number of whooping cough pertussis cases is way down. Polio, of course, has been eliminated from the U.S. And the idea that that you would either discredit the effectiveness and safety of these vaccines, or in some cases, this commitment to rhetoric around health freedom, medical freedom is so strong that that you no longer make vaccines required, even though it's to the detriment of kids and the detriment of school safety. So that was really concerning. So when you look at the modern history of the anti-vaccine movement, you know, it began in the late 1990s, early 2000s, with false claims that vaccines cause autism. Our friend Robert F. Kennedy was a big promoter of that. He wrote an article in Rolling Stone magazine and Salon magazine in 2005, claiming it was thimerosal preservative. And that followed on the heels of saying it was the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. They keep switching up what their assertions are. And that thread's still there. In fact, it's been resurrected now, the phony autism links, because of Kennedy being in head of Health and Human Services now. But then about 10 years ago, it took this interesting pivot around this concept of health freedom, medical freedom, a libertarian concept. And it started gaining traction in certain state governments because so much vaccine policy is done at the state level. So in my state of Texas, for instance, anti-vaccine groups started getting PAC money, political action committee money, to encourage the filing of anti-vaccine legislation and bills and to actually support candidates to run on anti-vaccine platforms. I mean, it made no sense, but you know, it was a way to promote a political agenda. And now that's been really prominent. I mean, there's a reason why we have COVID deaths so high in Republican majority states because of that anti-vaccine sentiment. And Charles Gaba, the health analyst for ACA Steinups, has now generated some pretty compelling data showing the higher percentage of Republican voters in a county, the lower the immunization rates, higher the death rates, so much so that New York Times just called it red COVID. I mean, red being Republican, blue being Democrat. And so that's really concerning, how this has become a political issue. And it's not that I care about your politics, that's right, as an American citizen, but how do you say don't adopt this stuff because it's so dangerous, and all the unnecessary COVID deaths and now two unnecessary measles deaths? So that's been the anti-vaccine movement, that kind of 1-2 punch of phony baloney about autism and then libertarian concepts of health freedom, medical freedom. And then a few years after that, there was a third thread that became apparent, and that was the health, wellness, and influencer movement, which is selling all sorts of things on the internet, and then often pairing it with telehealth visits. And oftentimes what the health and wellness industry will do is it's whatever they can buy in bulk. And have you ever wondered why are they all anti-parasitic drugs? Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, fenbendazole. It's because there's a lot of them available. They're cheap, low-cost generics. They can buy it in bulk, repackage it, jack up the price, and then they pair it with telehealth visits. And then you hear about it on Fox News at night, or you hear it about it on Joe Rogan podcast, so it gets actively promoted. So that's been the third thread. So first being false claims of autism, then libertarian concepts of health freedom, medical freedom, and now this third thread, the health, wellness, and influencer movement. And it's become its own empire. And it's interesting also how Mr. Kennedy, who I've had long interactions with in the past, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., now adjusts his rhetoric accordingly. So he was never that big in the health, wellness, influencer movement, but now he is. And so that's what, you know, MAHA is all about, Make America Healthy Again. It's very much connected to the wellness and influencer movement. So that explains why when, you know, he's talking about the measles epidemic and he gives kind of a half-hearted suggestion to parents to vaccinate your kids with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. But then he pivots and he says, or you can get this useless cocktail of supplements, vitamin A, budesimide, clarithromycin, cod liver oil. And you're scratching your head saying, where does that come from? Well, that's from the health and wellness and influencer movement that's gotten so strong in America.
Your book, Science Under Siege, that was just released, sets forth five proponents of the anti-science agenda. Could you briefly touch on those?
Sure. Full credit to Michael Mann here. That's his brilliance that came up with the five P's, which we call, and we'll go through it. We can go through them briefly one by one. The plutocrats, the petrostates, the pros, the propagandists, and the press, and can kind of explain how each of those are involved. So the plutocrats are, you know, the very high net worth individuals that use their influence to support think tanks that promote an anti-science agenda and do other things. So an example would be the Koch brothers, historically, you know, have, you know, which are very much dependent on their private company, that Koch Industries, that's very much focused around oil and gas and energy and attacking climate science. But then they started attacking mainstream public health interventions, and they support an institute in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, that partially support Institute Great Barrington, Massachusetts, called the AIER, the American Institute for Economic Research, that housed the location where the Great Barrington Declaration was created. And that basically says we should just let young people run around and get COVID, and then grandma and grandpa will put in a closet somewhere and feed them Swanson's TV dinners under the door. I guess I'm dating myself. I don't even know if they still have Swanson's TV dinner, but you get the idea. And of course, it was a completely ridiculous concept. But why would they say that? Well, they didn't want the economy to slow, and because that would hurt oil and gas prices. So that was an example where there is overlap between climate science and biomedicine. Or, you know, you look at Elon Musk, you know, as another kind of plutocrat who has been historically very pro-science, right? With, you know, creating SpaceX and Neuralink, you know, very science-driven companies. But then during the pandemic, on through his X platform, went full on anti-vaccine and taunted me to debate Robert F. Kennedy and the Joe Rogan show and that sort of thing. And so these plutocrats have become very powerful, and unfortunately, are not always using their wealth and power for good, for either to address climate change or address pandemics. So that's the plutocrats. And the petrostates, I mentioned briefly already. In the petrostates, it's obvious why they would want to attack, you know, climate change and climate scientists. Less obvious is why biomedicine. In many cases, these petrostates are far-right, you know, authoritarian entities that, again, attack public health and biomedicine for purposes of political control. And then you get to the pros, and the pros tend to be the credentialed individuals. Sometimes they're even professors at major universities who will turn against science and promote this contrarian agenda. They become talking heads on Fox News, or they're physicians who are heads of health and wellness companies or far-right physician groups that will promote ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine. And then you get to the propagandists who will try to amplify those messages. And you get people like Alex Jones, and I guess, unfortunately, Rogan's become in that category, that amplify the anti-science messages. And finally, the press is exemplified by the Murdoch media empire, Fox News, and all the damage they've done against climate change. And I also document their role in promoting anti-vaccine disinformation during the Delta wave in the last half of 2021. But not, and then the op-ed, the opinion section of the Wall Street Journal, which put out a lot of anti-science opinion pieces. But then, you know, there's also the mainstream press and how we're seeing this disturbing trend of both sidism that the, you know, newspapers like New York Times or the Washington Post, especially in their opinion sections, are putting out or having guest editorials or guest opinion pieces or even sometimes in-house opinion pieces that go against anything related to what the scientific community is saying, in quote, for reasons of fairness or to give both sides of the issue. Well, no, you don't do that if it's, you know, promoting, if it's putting out views that are not supported by the mainstream scientific community and actually are dangerous and put scientists under threat. So really, it's an effort. The five P's are a way to kind of give this big overview of the anti-science ecosystem.
Dr. Hotez, give me some hope. How can we combat the anti-science forces?
Well, I think the first thing that's important is to put it on the table, at least discuss it, just like you're doing right now. I think that that's a public service, because I think too often people hearing this stuff or seeing this stuff on podcasts or on the internet or on the cable news channels, they call it the infodemic or misinformation, like just some random junk out there on the internet. And it's not. It's organized. It's deliberate. It's, in some cases, politically motivated. In other cases, it's financially driven. And it's important to say that so to help people get their arms around it. So I think that in itself is a first step. I think also, you know, getting more scientists involved in public engagement. Not everybody wants to do it, but I think too often the scientific community is invisible because we're so busy writing and speaking for each other. And I get it, you know, not everybody, you know, especially when people see how I get beat up or how Mike gets beat up, you know, who wants that? But the consequence of not saying anything is we become invisible. I sometimes like to quote this study that comes out of Research America, a policy group based in D.C. that tracks what the American people feel about science. And it's really interesting. The numbers are pretty consistent. 75% of Americans cannot name a living scientist. And because we're invisible, and most Americans cannot name an institution where biomedical research is conducted. Again, so that, why is that? Because we're so focused on keeping our head down and staying out of the limelight in order to get our work done that, you know, when you become invisible like that, it allows the bad actors to portray us, as cartoon villains or people walking around in white coats plotting nefarious things. And, because there is that vacuum. So that I think is important to address. We also have a kind of a disappearing cadre of science journalists that are good at not allowing what the non-science journalists are doing that talk about science, which is allow all that false equivalency to step in. So one of the points of the book is there's agency here, that's Mike's term, there are things that we can do. And we do have to call it out, and we need our scientific societies and organizations to step up.
As you know, this is the podcast of the American Association for Physician Leadership. What duties do you think the medical profession has to the general public?
Well, I'm starting to think now about, because now the anti-science empire is even affecting government funding, right? It's affecting Medicaid, Medicare support. It's affecting NIH dollars. And that's on top of declining numbers of physician scientists. The new numbers, only 1.3% of physicians are physician scientists. So that kind of rounds off to zero, right? So the physician scientist is all but disappeared. But also, I think, you know, I think the Maha movement, which is really very much a pseudoscience or anti-science movement, is capitalizing on physician dissatisfaction, what some people call burnout, and how do we address that as well? And I think I have a new paper coming out soon, I hope, on the Baker Institute, because I'm linked to the James A. Baker Institute of Public Policy at Rice University website about, you know, how do we turn that around? And I think we do need to train physician leaders more in healthcare technologies and with declining government support, become more entrepreneurial. I do think there are things that really trying to find positive things that we can do, not just complain about the darkness, but see how, that we can create paths of light. And I think there are, and the books is a start at doing that, but there's more to come.
Medicine's both an art and a science, and we've seen extraordinary advancements in medical science, but maybe not so much in the art of medicine. Is it necessary now, paradoxically, for the profession to focus more on the art of medicine?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, how do we become more holistic? And one of the interesting trends that we've seen is this, in a sense, is return of what used to be called sectarian medicine. So if you go back to 1910 with the Flexner Report, where there was kind of a schism in American medicine, there was what some would call scientific medicine, right? Which is what, you know, we think about molecules and cells and designing new checkpoint inhibitors and mainstream scientific medicine. And that's clearly been an ascendancy throughout the 20th century. But in the past, you had this very strong sectarian type of medicine, meaning either homeopathy or eclectic medicine, eclecticism as it was called, botanicals. And that part of sectarian medicine never entirely disappeared, right? And that's now kind of morphed into the current health and wellness and influencer in industry. And now under MAHA, Make America Healthy Again, that's becoming ascendant again. And even though it's encouraged, you know, some of it is positive around processed foods and better nutrition and exercise. I don't think anybody has a problem with that. But there's also this big counter movement to discredit vaccines, to discredit psychiatry in favor of wellness and nutritional supplements and whatever other snake oil they're pushing. Why are they so effective? Because I think they address, as you point out, that art or that other side of medicine. So yeah, I think that is really important too. The opportunities now for new drugs, new diagnostics, new vaccines, new biologics, new cancer treatments, applying AI technology and virtual reality and all of the new technologies has made medicine stronger than ever. But if we don't address that holistic component too, the sectarian guys, the MAHA, the wellness and influencer industry are still going to have a lot of power and clout and say, and patients will suffer because of it.
Dr. Hotez, as our time together comes to an end, I would like you to speak directly to your colleagues practicing medicine. The troops need rallied, King Henry. What say you?
Well, I would remind them that they're all heroes. Right? They're doing the hard slogging, and there are many of us, especially in the scientific community, really appreciate their work. And I look at them with great empathy and in some cases sympathy, because what's happening is patients or their parents are coming in to your practices, and they're downloading all this stuff off the internet or hearing it from Fox News or Joe Rogan podcast, then they're made to feel like they're not keeping up with the biomedical literature. Well, you are keeping up with the biomedical literature. You're just not keeping up with the phony baloney stuff. And so how do you do that without getting angry or allowing it to contribute further to a very tough profession to begin with and rising rates of burnout? I think, you know, as best you can, look upon your patients with understanding and sympathy and recognize they themselves are victims of this disinformation campaign, and get familiar with it and hang in there, because opportunities in medicine are just only going to accelerate. And in this new paper I have coming out, hopefully in a few weeks, that really argues that we need to empower physicians more in healthcare technologies and not to get so mired in these attacks, and to be able to see the bigger picture.
My guest has been physician leader and patriot, Peter Hotez. The book is Science Under Siege. Dr. Hotez, thank you for all you've done, sir.
Thank you, and thank you for giving attention to this.
My thanks to Peter Hotez. He has stood up for vaccines and the medical profession time after time. His new book, Science Under Siege, should be read. Sound Practice wishes Dr. Hotez and his family peace and safety. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. Batman and Robin, Redwood Kapow.